You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 6th of May 2019. It's a bank holiday and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. And I am very pleased to say that I do have my co-host with me today, back after 2 weeks off, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. It's been a very relaxing weekend, I suppose. That's what I've had so far.
Good, good. I've had a couple of weekends off and we've got some nice weather out there today as well. So, did you have nice weather while you were off? Did you have a nice break?
Yeah, we've had some pretty good weather. It was a little bit showery yesterday, and it was quite sunny earlier on today, and it's a little bit overcast now, but not quite so sunny, but it's still a nice day.
Well, it's certainly raining and thunder and lightning on the Conservative Party at the moment, because we had the council elections last week that we're going to be talking a little bit about today. And as we predicted, they were wiped out, completely wiped out. And in actual fact, the Conservative Party ended up losing 1,269 seats. And the Labour Party, who thought that they were going to actually win seats, they ended up losing 63 seats as well. And UKIP, who we had been hoping were going to do very well, although I did have a suspicion they might not do so well, they actually saw a loss of 36 seats. And the big winners were the Liberal Democrats, who won 676 seats, and the Greens, who won 185 seats. And that may look as if it's people supporting parties that don't want to leave the European Union. But I think there's something different to this. I really do think there's something different to this, because these are local elections. So what you're essentially voting for is somebody that you think is going to do a good job of looking after all the local things that need doing, the things that councils do. They don't have anything to do with immigration policy. They don't have anything to do with stopping the Islamisation of Britain, stopping the grooming gangs, none of that. They basically just deal with council issues. So the fact that UKIP's standing against all of those things really wouldn't have made that much of a difference, because I don't really know that UKIP would do that well at council level. And the Liberal Democrats, of course, they've got a record of doing very well, actually, at the council level. They usually do end up with quite a few councillors, but they don't do so well in the general election. So just to let our American listeners know, this was basically just local elections. It wasn't a general election. But it has really slammed the Conservatives in a big way, this massive loss of theirs. This is the way that I see it, Max. I don't think this is support for parties that don't want to leave the EU. I think this is more support for people that are going to do the job well at being councillors, and maybe a bit of support for the Greens, because they've had all this publicity recently with the Rebellion Extinction or whatever it's called, with that little girl from Sweden. The autistic girl that seems to have been put on a pedestal and is allowed to talk to all the politicians. It's obviously controlled opposition, because she gets a chance to talk to all the politicians. But I think that may have affected people as well, and that's why they voted Greens. What did you think of these recent council elections, Max?
Well, I have to agree to a certain extent with what you've been saying. I think that some of the vote that went to the Lib Dems and the Greens will have been, as you say, the fact that people were just looking around. Well, I suppose particularly with regard to the Lib Dems, because they've got a proven track record of managing a number of councils. Looking at them with regard to a local political party that would look after the local issues, which are not you know, particularly important to us nationally at this troubled time. But I also think that a lot of people were just wanted to punish both the Conservatives and the Labour Party, who they see as responsible for the Brexit fiasco, and the Lib Dems and the Greens just seem to be suitable people that they could vote for, because there seems to have been quite a large number of people elected as independents as well, and I would imagine the independents would be people who obviously won't be representing the two major parties and will be somebody that somebody could vote for in the local elections in order to punish the big parties. And so I think there's an element of that in it. I think there probably also is an element that the Lib Dems and the Greens picked up some votes where there were people who actually wanted to place a vote against leaving the European Union. And I think that took place to a greater extent than there were people who were voting Brexiteers, just simply by virtue of the fact that ever since the referendum back in 2016, there's been a deluge of propaganda. There's been a lot of developments that have taken place that have given heart to the Lib Dems, that have given heart to the Greens, insofar as immediately after the referendum, we were all looking forward to Brexit. Then very, very quickly, those people who were opposed to us leaving the European Union managed to float the idea, and the media picked up on it and have made on it ever since, that whilst people voted for Brexit, that they didn't necessarily vote for a clean break Brexit, which I think people did, because if you go back and you look at all of the propaganda that was put out at the time, if you look at all of the leaflets that the government put out, government made it quite clear that us leaving the European Union was going to be a clean break Brexit, and that's the reason why they said that they didn't want us to leave the European Union, because there was only one idea of Brexit at that particular point in time, which was the clean break Brexit. It was only after the Brexiteers winning the referendum that the Remainers suddenly decided that there were several different shades of Brexit, and they've obviously invented these several different shades of Brexit in order to confuse the issue. And what they've seen since is the likes of Theresa May and the other leading Conservatives and the Labour Party just completely fudging the issue over and over again and frustrating the progress of Brexit, and now achieving a situation in which the very best we can hope for is not actually a clean break Brexit, but it's going to be Brexit in name only, Theresa May's dog's breakfast of a Brexit. That's the best that we can hope for now, really. So the Lib Dems have had a massive amount to boost their morale with regard to over the last couple of years or so. And exactly the same with the Greens. The Greens have been a consistently anti-Brexit party, and they will have taken heart from the fact that they will have seen the whole issue fudged and frustrated in the way that we have, and the way that we've reported so many times. Whereas as far as the people who voted for us to leave the European Union are concerned, we have been demoralised. We have had, as I said earlier, we've had this deluge of negative propaganda portraying a clean break Brexit as being plunging off of a cliff, as being akin to a car crash. All of these kind of adjectives have been used in order to conjure up an unappealing image of what Brexit is actually going to mean. And people who voted for us to leave the European Union have seen their hopes and their wishes frustrated at every step and turn along the way for 2.5 years now. And there just doesn't appear to be any end to what is going on. And so I imagine a lot of people who voted Brexit were, perhaps didn't even bother to vote, and probably felt that their vote was worthless, that democracy in this country no longer exists, and that there's no real point in actually voting because nobody takes any notice of what you say.
Well, that's a good point there, and I didn't actually look to see what the turnout figures were, because that would be interesting. I do know that there were a lot of ballot papers that were defaced, which we'll get into a little bit later on. But I'm just thinking about this UKIP loss here, and they did actually stand hundreds of councillors, which I'm just wondering, maybe they might have done a little bit better to have concentrated their resources just on a few councils that they thought that they'd be likely to win. I know that Britain First, they did that, and they actually came second in one of the wards that they were standing in. I think they stood in two areas, basically, and they came second. I think they defeated two of the main parties, Conservative and Labour, which is very good of them. You know, that's quite a success. And I do think when we have these EU elections in 2 weeks' time, I think it is now, I think that's when we're going to see a real drubbing of the anti-Brexit parties. Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, that's leading in the polls. UKIP aren't doing so well in the polls, but they have got these famous people that are standing. They've got Mark Meacham, they've got Carl Benjamin, who we've talked about before, and also Gerard Batner. And I think those three will get voted in, which of course is going to make life very, very interesting. And also I think Tommy Robinson is going to get voted in, who we'll talk about a little later on as well. But just keeping with these council elections, one interesting incident happened afterwards, and this actually took place at a Conservative conference, and Theresa May was heckled. The Prime Minister has been heckled at a Welsh Conservative conference after her party suffered huge losses in English council elections. "Why don't you resign?" party member Stuart Davies told Theresa May before he was shouted down and escorted from the premises in Llangollen. Mrs. May said the election results gave both the Conservatives and Labour a simple message to get on with Brexit. She insisted to BBC Wales that the Welsh Conservative Party supports her. But Mr. Davies yelled across the hall, "We don't want you, nobody wants you," as Mrs. May began her speech to conference. And then the audience then shouts, "Out, out, out, out." And it's very hard to tell whether the audience were chanting for Mrs. May to leave, or whether they were actually chanting for this guy to be kicked out. And this heckler, who was actually a member of the Clwyd South Conservative Association, which recently passed a motion of no confidence in the Prime Minister, accused her of dragging the party into disrepute. He said, "We saw the results. There's only one way. It's down," he told BBC Wales after being ejected. "We need a new Prime Minister, and we need that new Prime Minister as soon as possible." Mr. Davies, 71, said, "I am furious at what she has done to our party. To put it bluntly, she is telling lies. We will be out by the 29th of March. I think I share the views of a lot of people who are party members. I did what I did because I knew that it was the right thing to do." Asked if the heckler was saying what many Welsh Conservatives were saying in private, Mrs. May told BBC Wales, "I think you saw the reaction from everybody in the hall. They did not want that to be said." And that's absolute nonsense, because that Welsh Conservative Association have already passed a motion of no confidence in her. 60% of the Conservative Party members have said that they are going to be voting for the Brexit Party. And I think it's something like 40% of the actual Conservative MPs have said they're going to vote for the Brexit Party in the EU elections. The Brexit Party weren't even standing in these council elections. But this woman is just, you know, she just won't believe what is happening. She's got so much arrogance. She thinks that the Conservative Party still support her. Everywhere she goes, she gets heckled. Her party have said, you know, they would rather be working with Nigel Farage than working with Jeremy Corbyn. And she's working with Jeremy Corbyn. She's gone totally against her party, totally against her manifesto, totally against everything that she has said to the general public. I think the 1922 committee, they're going to be meeting with her this week and saying, "You have got to say that you are, when you are going to leave." Ian Duncan Smith, a previous prime minister, had said this week, she has to say when she is going to leave. She's just sort of holding on there by a legal technicality that they can't kick her out, because she won this vote of no confidence back in December, which I think was a setup just so that she would win that, because it was impossible to get her out, and then we'd be stuck with her for a year. But I did enjoy the fact that this elderly man was brave enough to just stand up and start heckling her. I think we need to see more of this. Did you see this at all? Did you spot this on the news there, Max?
I heard it on the radio a couple of times. I don't think this chap has been quite so prominently promoted by the mass media as the chap who heckled Jeremy Corbyn at the Labour Friends of Israel meeting. Do you remember the guy who shouted out, "Say the name, Israel, say the name"?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And the very next day he was on the, he was being interviewed on TV, and he got interviewed on TV a number of times, and much was made of the fact that he'd said what he did. And I don't think as much has been made of this this heckler of Theresa May, and that's really because I think Theresa May is doing the establishment's bidding, whereas the establishment wanted to damage Jeremy Corbyn. And so as far as Theresa May is concerned, I mean, I think that she was, well, she definitely was a Remainer during the referendum campaign. Whether she has deliberately engineered Brexit onto the rocks, or whether it's just been as a result of her incompetence, that's a matter for debate. But the fact of the matter is that she has steered inadvertently or otherwise the Conservative Party onto the rocks. She seems to be totally out of her depth. She walks around gurning all the time. She has got a very awkward shuffle in the way that she walks, which makes it look as if she's got something wrong with her. It's almost that in every step and turn along the way where she has to make a decision, as this heckler said on one of the radio programs I listen to, at every step and turn where she's had to make a decision, she's consistently made the wrong decision. And the
she's
decision that instinctively is anathema to most Conservatives. And so therefore, it isn't surprising that most Conservatives now, you know, want to get rid of her. And I think the only reason she hasn't gone already is because most Conservatives were worried that unseating her would actually damage their party and damage the party's electoral prospects, thinking that it would perhaps force a general election or something. But as their cowardice in not getting rid of her straight away and much earlier on, is that the situation now is much graver, the situation now is much worse for them, and it's going to be that much more damaging when they eventually do unseat her and get her to step down. Because it isn't surprising to me that the vast majority of people in this country just have got no confidence in the Conservatives, for the very reason that they have supported Theresa May and that they've allowed her to carry on driving the United Kingdom, despite the fact that she is the most awful driver this country could have possibly had.
They should have kicked her out last year when she announced that she was going to ignore all the negotiations that her Brexit committee had been making with the EU and was instead going to do a secret plan that she had been working on behind everybody else's backs. That's when they should have kicked her out. And then she made this announcement at Chequers, and her Brexit team all resigned. And then she showed it all to the public, and again her Brexit secretary resigned. And since then we've had loads of resignations, and the Tory party have been split over it. And I mean, everybody could see this coming years ago. I mean, the woman is a progressive. She's a progressive feminist, and she's known nothing else but the EU. All she knows how to do is take orders from the EU. So she's not capable of leading a country on her own. She's not leadership material. She's, in the words of one of these other conservatives, she's a caretaker prime minister. She was just parachuted in because they were so shocked that that the Leave vote won and that David Cameron stepped down. Really, what they should have done is taken on somebody like Nigel Farage and said, right, you deal with it. You were the one that got this Brexit vote. You were the one saying we need to leave the EU. We will now leave it all up to you so that the rest of the government can get on with the day-to-day business of running the country. And instead, they've spent 3 years trying to think of a way to overturn this vote, and Theresa May has done all these dodgy deals behind closed doors with the EU, and that this really does show that that's who her loyalty is to, because otherwise she would have stepped down a long time ago. The only people that are backing her are the EU. Her own party isn't backing her. The general public aren't backing her. They just showed that in this election. It's just the EU. It's just Merkel and Macron and all the other traitors from Europe. They think she's wonderful, and they're the only people that do. As I said, we've also had we've had a ton of ballot papers that were spoiled as well. Voters dissatisfied with the Tory government's failure to deliver Brexit have spoilt their local election ballots, writing in Brexit Party and traitor, besides the name of Conservatives and Labour candidates. Sky News political journalist John Craig reported late last night that in Bury, Greater Manchester, a number of voters were expressing their frustration at not getting a proper choice of candidates because they lacked a clear pro-Brexit party and they were spoiling their ballots in large numbers. The movement spread across England, with voters having taken to writing in Brexit Party and comments like traitor besides the name of the establishment party candidates. Four Remain parties and the effing Tories, none. And get out Theresa May. And sharing pictures of them.
I found it quite amusing the way in which so many Conservatives that were, not just Conservatives, but a large number of them were Conservatives that stated when they were interviewed either on TV or the radio that this was the very first time in their lives that they had ever spoiled their ballot paper. And it was almost like this was like the most daring thing they'd ever done. It reminded me of when Theresa May was first Prime Minister and she was interviewed and she'd asked whether she'd ever done anything bad. And she said that yes, when she was a little girl, she once ran through a field of corn. And it just sort of made me laugh that was, you know, what she regarded as, you know, the worst thing that she had done in her childhood, which is laughable, really. And it was laughable the way in which so many of these Conservatives, you know, felt that they were being so daring in terms of spoiling their ballot papers. And they were even saying things like, you know, and there wasn't a midnight knock afterwards, as if they thought that these security services would hunt them down as people, you know, who'd committed a heinous crime. When, you know, as far as most nationalists are concerned, you know, we've become used to the fact that, you know, quite often in the area where we live, there isn't a candidate and we're faced with, you know, the Lib Lab con, and of course there's nobody there that we want to vote for, and so we have found ourselves reluctantly spoiling our ballot papers quite often over the years. And whenever I've been a polling agent, and when I've been an election agent at the count, spoiling of ballot papers does actually have quite an effect on the candidates, because. Every single ballot paper has to be held up in front of each of the candidates and their agents for them to perhaps contest whether they think it is a spoiled ballot paper or not. And so, if you stood in an election and you've been, you know, consistently pro-immigration, pro-common market, anti-capital punishment, etc., weak on crime, and then you see hundreds of ballot papers where people have denounced you, with messages they've scrawled across their ballot papers, it does actually have a fair bit of a psychological effect on the candidates and the agents. So I've often enjoyed, when I've been an election agent, watching the faces of these other candidates as ballot papers have been presented to them. And so I think that what has been a first in experience terms for lots of Conservatives at this local election is probably going to become a far more common thing in the future, because, you know, lots of people have spoiled their ballot papers for the first time, and lots of people have heard from other people who have spoiled their ballot papers for the first time in their lives. And I think it's going to be something that will probably catch on in areas where there are just establishment candidates.
It seems like it's a good idea to actually do that then. I mean, the Conservatives, I mean, they are feeling totally betrayed. I mean, we've got people that are dyed-in-the-wool Conservatives that are leaving them to go and support Nigel Farage. Jacob Rees-Mogg's sister, I mean, she was out at 5 or 6 years old handing out Conservative Party leaflets. I mean, you've been blue through and through for her entire life, and she's turned her back on them, and she's now supporting Brexit. I mean, that's the betrayal that these Conservative Party supporters feel. As you say, they were sharing their pictures of these ballots on Twitter as well, under the hashtag #SpoilYourBallot, and it's been written about in the newspapers. Attention has been drawn to this. Others had written on their ballots, leave the EU on WTO terms, i.e. leaving the bloc in a clean break in deal scenario. Respect the Brexit vote or simply Brexit. One election official at the Ipswich Corn Exchange told the Daily Mail, we thought there'd be quite a few spoilt ballots, but nothing on the level that we have seen. It took everyone by surprise. There seems to be a lot of anger and frustration out there. How can they say they're surprised that there was that much anger and frustration? Almost 800 spoiled ballots were reported in Basildon by BBC Essex, reportedly in protest against the government handling of Brexit and the lack of a party to represent them. And the Rugby Advertiser reported that there were hundreds of spoiled ballots, many of which were overwritten with the words Brexit, and more than 500 spoiled in North Norfolk. I mean, so this is quite an uprising as far as spoiled ballots are concerned. As you say, this is something that nationalists have been doing for years. Max, is there anything else you want to talk about with us?
Well, I just as like a humorous aside, I can remember an occasion when my wife and I both agreed we were going to spoil our ballot papers, and we went into the polling station, and she obviously went into the cubicle to mark her paper and did it very quietly with the pencil that was provided. But I'd taken this felt tip pen with me so that I could write quite boldly across the ballot paper. And when I came out of the cubicle, my wife was looking quite embarrassed. And she was like looking at the people who were there to, you know, in attendance, and sort of looking at me. And what I then realised was that I'd gone into this cubicle and I'd written quite a long message in very bold black lettering across this ballot paper. And all you could hear from outside was the squeaking of this felt tip pen going, she said it was absolutely obvious I was spoiling my ballot paper and that I wasn't actually putting a cross on there. And so I thought it was quite amusing. Another occasion was where I had stood as a candidate for British National Party, and somebody who, in fact, there were several people who had done this, who had decided that they were going to protest that there had been a BNP candidate standing, and they, instead of putting a cross in the box next to the candidate that they wanted, they had drawn a little swastika in the box next to my name, and the presiding officer decided that these were spoilt ballot papers because there wasn't a cross or a tick, you know, there was just these swastikas in the boxes. But then I then insisted that these swastikas were crosses, and said that
so
they were
a
votes
vote for
that
you.
Counted for me. and in the end, they gave in and let me have them. So I thought that was quite amusing as well.
Nice one. Well, that's the council elections. But also, while this has been going on, obviously we've had the campaigning for the EU elections, and we've covered Sargon of Akkad a couple of times. He's still having his, I think he's calling it his anti-fascist parade, Carl Benjamin's anti-fascist parade. I'm not sure why he's called that. Maybe it's because of all the anti-fascist protesters that he's had to deal with while he's been having these debates. But they have been quite interesting debates. He also did a very good interview with Gibraltar on the news over there at Gibraltar, where he totally owned the journalist, and you could see she was furious at him. She really hated him. So just for entertainment value, I'd recommend people check out what Sargon's been up to. But also, Tommy Robinson has now stepped into the arena, and he's standing for the Northwest as an independent for the European Union. And his campaign so far, really, I mean, he really should have expected this, but he's been assaulted countless times. He's being physically attacked when he's out there on the streets. He's getting a great response from people. I mean, wherever he goes in the country, you can see he's just mobbed by people wanting to take selfies with him or hug him or shake his hand or whatever. But because he's been announcing where he's going, there's been this organized resistance against him, and they've got very, very physical with him. I mean, he's been punched. This girl just went wild at him, trying to punch him in the face. this Muslim guy threw a milkshake over him. Twice he's had a milkshake thrown over him. And you've got to remember, I mean, this could be acid that's thrown at him. I mean, all he knows is that a liquid has hit him. And the response to this from the mainstream media and from the politicians has been absolutely disgusting. They've been supporting it. They've been encouraging it. They've been saying, well, I'd like to buy that lad another milkshake. And you think, well, Jeremy Corbyn, he got hit by an egg. And the person that did that got 28 days in prison. And you think Anna Soubry, she got called a Nazi, and the guy is on trial for that at the moment. And yet here is Tommy Robinson. He's got a right to campaign. He's got a right to go on the streets and campaign, and he should be being protected. And he's not being protected. He's being attacked, and the establishment are not standing up for him. And I've watched some of this, and you could say that maybe he is provoking it a bit, because he really shouldn't be going up to them. I mean, he's going up to these people, and he's doing his usual, well, go on then, you know, where have I ever been racist? And, you know, the usual spiel that he does, and asking them why they are jumping up and down and being excited and all of this. So, you know, it is almost like he is provoking them a bit. And, you know, I can't have too much sympathy for him when he does that, to be honest. Have you seen any of this going on, Max?
Well, I did see the video of Tommy Robinson getting the milkshake thrown over him, and yeah, I mean, this is it is disgusting that the media encourage people to do this sort of thing, and it's where there is this complete this twofold approach, really, where if anything happens to anybody who's a member of the political establishment, it's the most horrendous and horrific thing that's ever happened. And yet when it happens to somebody who is more right-wing than the Conservative Party, well, it's us getting our just desserts, and, you know, all power to the elbow of the person that's doing it. And it's like when we look at the way in which Antifa have been able to operate as as effectively a low-grade terrorist organisation for decades now, where they set out not with the intention of engaging in any particular political campaign, not with the intention of engaging in any political argument, but they set out with the intention of physically attacking people that they regard as fascists. And yet Antifa have not been declared a terrorist organisation. They're an organisation that uses violence and the threat of violence for political purposes, and terrorist organisation, and they should be shut down under the government's current anti-terrorism legislation. And you can imagine what would happen, and you know, we saw what happened with National Action, where some members of National Action just voiced in a kind of oblique support for that Moat guy, whatever his name is. And they were then summarily shut down and declared to be a terrorist organisation, and so there is this double approach, really, where the establishment, where they're very, very easy on people who are doing the establishment's work for them, and they are very, very severe if anybody from the right or from nationalism tries to do anything like the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's total double standards. I mean, these Antifa, I mean, they just use their fists. They're obviously very low intelligence. They haven't really got any answer when they're confronted. And then they just seize the chance, since they're actually close to the person that they hate so much, and then they just let fly. And I mean, I could see that. It did seem to me that when Tommy Robinson was going to the police and he was saying, these two women have been assaulted, and then he shows you the video of it, and this Muslim guy sort of pushes past one of them. But I mean, that is just jostling. I mean, that's not assault. I mean, going to the police and saying you should arrest this man for assault, that's a bit over the top. I mean, if you were at a festival or any large gathering of people, you are going to get jostled. So I do think, you know, that the he doesn't do himself any favours by saying that this man should be arrested to the police. And at another instant, I mean, the police car, there was just two police there, and they got into the police car, and they were surrounded by Antifa, absolutely surrounded. And Tommy was saying, look, you should be arresting these people. You should arrest this person, arrest this man. And I was thinking, well, police are probably getting a little bit worried by all that Antifa there. There's only two of them. It may not have been a good idea to arrest that man because they may have feared that, you know, the crowd might have gone for the police. I mean, that's the situation where we are in now in multicultural Britain, is the police are too scared to actually make arrests because the public aren't going to help them. The public are going to help the criminal, and they have done in lots of instances, especially that we've seen in London. So I do think Tommy could be managing his campaign better. He shouldn't be going to the police about people that are being jostled, and he should try and keep away from these Antifa. Don't engage with them. Don't try and have a talk with them or a debate. I mean, it's the same with Sargon. He's gone up to some of these Antifa and tried to talk to them, and they've thumped him as well and tried to throw his phone to the ground. I mean, they're just animals. Just treat them like dangerous animals. Keep away from them. And say to the police, look, you knew that we were coming here today. You need to keep those people separate from us. And that's all I can advise, really. And I think Tommy is saying that he's only got three security guards with him, and he's asking for donations so that he can get more security guards. And I think that's a good cause to donate to, because, you know, I'd really like to see him get in to the EU. I think he is going to be voted in. I think he is going to get the support, and he does need security, and he does need to think these things out, basically, and not give the Antifa what they want, which is a chance to get close to him so they can thump him and get their name in the newspapers. And then to see the MPs cheering that on is absolutely disgusting. And yesterday, David Lammy actually made a tweet, which is just incredible that this guy can get away with what he says on Twitter. This is the exact tweet that David Lammy sent out. Young people have the power to stop the rise of the hard right. You know what to do. And then there's an image of a black fist punching, not punching the air, but punching. So he's quite clear. He's saying that young people should go out and beat up the hard right. And this is in response to Tommy Robinson's campaigning. And I just thought that is just absolutely disgusting, to have an MP inciting young people to go out and punch their political opponents. You know, that's the level that politics has descended to in Britain. And
it's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting.
I mean, they like you say, I mean, this Antifa group, they are a terrorist organisation. And you can just see that from all their promotional work, all they talk about. It's all about smash the fash. You know, just violently shut them down. You have to shut them down. And that's all they talk about. That's all they advocate. And now they've got, you know, a famous Labour MP that appears to be condoning this, supporting this. So we'll just have to see what happens. You know what will happen? I mean, these Antifa will go for Tommy once he has his security there, and they will hammer the Antifa, and then it will all be in the press that, there was a big riot at Tommy Robinson's demonstration, and his supporters were seen hitting people. And that will be the way that it's reported. This milkshake incident, they said, the milkshake slipped out of his hand. And you can see on the video, you know, he deliberately throws it at him. And it could be acid.
Yeah, it's quite obvious. And going back a few years, if we look at the situation when Nick Griffin was the leader of the BNP, the media made a great meal of the fact that wherever he went, he had, you know, perhaps four bodyguards with him. And they used to claim that he was parading around like some kind of gangster because he got all these heavies there to defend him. But you know, literally, he had to have those people there. If he hadn't had those people there, he would have been beaten up. And that's what the public have got to learn. The public have got to learn that when the media labels somebody a fascist or a Nazi or a thug, it's just a tactic that they use. The thuggishness of nationalists and people on the right is just purely self-defense. If people didn't learn how to fight, if people didn't have bodyguards, then we would just be beaten up, and there would be, you know, completely zero democracy in this country. There would be only those political parties that, and anybody else would just get beaten up every time they went out into the streets. And it wouldn't stop with nationalists. It would, you know, if Antifa are able to get away with it, they will become bolder and bolder. and they'll start to direct their campaigns at Conservative candidates and Conservative activists, and it will spread. And this is the sort of thing that the government are allowing by having the double standard and by allowing Antifa to engage in their terrorist activities without any restriction.
And they've removed the ability of Tommy Robinson and Carl Benjamin to actually challenge this on social media. You know, there's been direct meddling in the political process in the EU elections, because Twitter have removed both their accounts, and these weren't Carl Benjamin's personal account or Tommy Robinson's personal account. These were the campaign accounts that were managed by other people that were just informing people what was going on with the campaign. And Twitter has removed them. Of course, Facebook have unpersoned Tommy Robinson and a lot of other people. He's not on Instagram anymore. YouTube have put all his videos into limited state, and not because he'd even had any of them flagged, but because the Labour Party, Tom Watson, went to Facebook and demanded that and YouTube, and demanded that his videos and his page be taken down. So all he's got left is Telegram. But it does look like a lot of people are going on there to find out the truth. And this does help to wake our people up, I think, to the lies that the media are telling about us. Because, you know, it's not that hard just to look things up on Telegram, or to look Tommy Robinson up on YouTube and make it past the limited state side of it. So this will help to wake our people up anyway. And of course, the EU elections are in a couple of weeks' time. So we've got another couple of weeks' worth of interesting coverage, I think, keeping up with it. Well, let's change the subject a bit here now. And I know that you've been looking at something the universities have been talking about doing, Max, decolonising the curriculum. So do you want to tell us about that?
Well, it's just that over the course of the last 12 months or so, I've noticed that, first of all, at Oxford University, there was this campaign by some of the African students there to have the statue of Cecil Rhodes taken down. And Cecil Rhodes was a colonial explorer and who helped to expand the British Empire and to I think established a lot of the mining that was taking place in South Africa, and who used the great wealth that he accumulated to sponsor good causes here in the UK. And so he gave large amounts of money to Oxford University, and this money, these endowments, have sponsored the Rhodes Scholars for many years after his death. Then we also had, I think it was last year, we had a campaign in Bristol to have the statue of Edward Colston removed, and for a number of institutions that were established as a result of his philanthropy, the campaign was to force those organisations to change their name, and so to take his name off of the name of that institution. And now we've had, more recently, we've had Cambridge University declaring that they're going to have a two-year investigation into the extent to which Cambridge University benefited from the slave trade, with a view to doing what they call decolonising the curriculum. Now, decolonising the curriculum is just a sort of meaningless slogan, effectively, because I would imagine that there's very little of the curriculum that's actually taught in either Cambridge or in Bristol.
Oxford,
that's right. I went blank this minute. Or in Oxford, I bet there's very little in the curriculum that has anything to do with slavery, that has anything to do with the promotion of colonialism or anything of that sort. So there really isn't anything to decolonise. What they really want to do is they want to erase the history of these places. They want to take away the fact that very successful white men whose personal histories and whose lives may have been tainted to some extent by involvement in slavery during those times, they want to remove the names of those people as part of a generalised campaign to basically whitewash white people out of history, and so that there is less and less to remind us of our history, and less to remind us of the great people who contributed towards the culture of our country. And yet, it has to be said that some of these people, their lives were to some extent tainted by their involvement in the slave trade, but the wealth that these people accumulated, they used for good purposes. And in fact, as far as Edward Colston is concerned, you know, he was born in 1636, he died in 1721, but his involvement with slavery began in 1680 when he joined the Royal African Company. And it wasn't just purely slavery, he was involved in trade. And so there were commodities such as cloths and oil and wine and fruit and things of this sort that he traded in as well. So the actual slave trade only represented a proportion of the work that he was involved in. He joined the Royal African Company in 1680. He became the deputy governor of that organization by the time he resigned and retired, and which he did just 12 years later. So for just 12 years of his life, he was involved with a company that operated in Africa as a trading company, where some of the trade was in slaves. And it was trading slaves where they weren't actually enslaving people, but what they were doing was that they were buying slaves from the African tribes who had conquered other African tribes, and who were then happy to sell the slaves that they had acquired through their conquests to white traders. And that's the way that the slave trade developed. And so it wasn't that people like Edward Colston went out to Africa with the deliberate intention of enslaving people just willy-nilly. He went out to Africa to trade, and one of the commodities that the company that he represented was offered was slaves. And because in those days it wasn't illegal to trade in slaves, the white traders of those times made the error of getting involved in that kind of thing. However, as far as slavery and the transatlantic slavery is concerned, transatlantic slavery wasn't entirely a situation where the slaves were all black people and the slave masters were all white, because there were quite large numbers of the slave masters who were Arabic. There were quite large numbers of slave traders who were Jewish. And as far as the actual slaves were concerned, very large numbers of the slaves, and it's been estimated that as many as 20% of all the slaves that were transported over to the Caribbean, the southern states of the United States, as many as 20% of them were actually white people. And there's a very interesting book, I think it's written by a chap called, I think it's Gary Hoffman. It's certainly Hoffman, but it's
Michael
called
Hoffman.
They Were White and They Were Slaves.
Yeah. Michael Hoffman.
Michael Hoffman.
It's a good book.
And so Michael Hoffman wrote this book, and if you read his book, it's very interesting, and it tells a story about how people who were poor, people who committed very petty crimes like stealing a loaf of bread, or who actually were just vagrants who just had nowhere to live and were sleeping on the streets, those people were rounded up in those days and were transported to the colonies and to the southern states of America as indentured slaves. And as indentured slaves, that the terms of their indenture were that if they tried to escape during the period of their indenture, then the period of their indenture could be extended by another 10 years. And so what the slave masters used to do in those days was that they would start to mistreat their slaves to an intolerable degree, just as their period of indenture was coming to an end, so that the people would then be driven to try to escape. And of course, once they tried to escape, then their period of indenture would be extended for another 10 years. And so effectively this indentured servitude eventually became lifelong slavery, and lots of the people who were sold into lifelong slavery in that way that were white were then treated exactly the same way as the black slaves were. They worked in the fields alongside the black slaves, and they were treated like cattle, and they were expected to breed with the black slaves as well. And And so, you know, when people talk about there being, there having to be compensation paid to the African countries and to the so-called African-American people of the United States of America, to compensate them for the fact that their ancestors were slaves. Well, you know, some of that money perhaps ought to be paid back to communities here in Britain, because it's communities here in Britain that had our people stolen from us to go into that, to contribute towards that slavery as well. So it wasn't a situation where it was a crime committed by white people against black people. It was a crime committed by people who were effectively big business people, people who were trading all over the world, people who were, what should we call them? Let's call them global business people. They were people who were busily building global trading empires, just as there are people busily building global trading empires today who've got no affinity with the communities and the peoples from which they came, and who've become completely deracinated, and whose main preoccupation is making a profit, and that's what motivated these people. So I just think that it's such a shame that so few people have actually got the courage to speak up about the way in which slavery is being used as a stick to beat white people with, when in reality, you know, we suffered as a result of it just as much as anybody else.
The actual story about, you know, this mistreatment of the blacks, actually it was mistreatment of the whites. So there was an incentive to mistreat the whites. There was no incentive to mistreat the blacks. I mean, they were slaves. If you have property, like if you have a car, you're not going to mistreat it. You're going to look after it. You're going to service it. I mean, these were property. These were human resources that people had spent a lot of money on. And those Rhodes scholarships, that you're talking about, a lot of the people that were saying decolonize the curriculum and pull down the Rhodes statue were actually young Negroes that were on Rhodes scholarships, that were actually profiting from his philanthropy, from his desire to teach people that were bright, regardless of race, and they were actually profiting from that, and they were the ones that were demanding that his statue be torn down. And one thing that I always question about this, when they say, well, we need reparations, and we need to investigate Oxford and Cambridge to see how much profit they made from slaves. Well, hang on a minute. Those slaves were bought fair and square from the African traders. They were human resources that the African traders sold. The money was paid for them. The money went to the African traders. So why aren't these African traders being tracked down and investigated? Why isn't Africa itself being asked to provide these reparations? Because it was at the Africans themselves that were selling other Africans. And you could look at it that the white man liberated these other Africans, because if they'd been bought by other Negroes, they could well have ended up being eaten. They could well have ended up being sacrificed. They would have been mistreated. Instead, they were taken by the white man, who clothed them, fed them, kept them warm, gave them medicine, taught them how to read and write, let them have a modicum of freedom. They were even allowed to marry one another with mock wedding ceremonies. They didn't actually have the same standing in civil society as a real wedding, because they weren't a part of civil society. But they were certainly treated much, much better in America than they ever would have been in Africa. They'd been bought and paid for fair and square. Then they were properly freed. They were liberated. And at that time, the people that had paid for these slaves, they were refunded. So these blacks are actually paid for twice. And now they're saying they want reparations, and we need to investigate how much money was made from the slave trade so that they can be paid for a third time. These Negroes think that they are entitled to be paid for three times. I mean, just paying for them the once was enough. And if they think that was wrong, they should be going to the African traders that sold them in the first place. Don't you think they should be going to these African chiefs and saying, what did you do with all the money? What did you do with all the money that these rich British traders paid you for us? Can we have that money back? Yeah. Not us.
And also the thing that's completely ignored is the extent of modern-day slavery in Africa, because African tribes that are trying to migrate their way to towards Europe, or not African tribes, African peoples that are trying to migrate their way towards Europe, have to go through countries where the predominant ethnic population of those countries are Berbers and Arabs and Egyptians, etc. And lots of these people are getting enslaved as a result of, in order to pay for their transport, etc. They become lots of the young females become lured into the sex trade. Lots of the men get lured into forced labour. The children get lured into child slavery. Lots of them get lured into ritual slavery, where they that they're recruited so that they can perform some purpose in some crude religious ceremony that nobody would willingly want to sort of engage in. And there are lots of people who are sold again into indentured servitude. And this is going on in the countries that are listed, if you investigate into this, are Chad, the Congo, Ethiopia, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Madagascar, Mali, Mauritania. It's estimated that a fifth of the population of Mauritania are slaves. Niger, Sudan, and also now South Africa. And so all this slave trade is still going on. And I'm not just talking about an odd handful of people. There are tens of thousands of people each year being sold into slavery still in Africa today. They're being sold into slavery in Africa by other Africans and by the various alternate ethnic groups that exist in North Africa. But nobody's saying anything about it. Nobody's complaining about it and pointing to the fact that the transatlantic slave trade obviously wasn't started by white people. The slave trade was made illegal in our country, and whilst it is nominally illegal in most African countries, in practice it's not. It's something that Africans have continued to do to each other ever since. And so in terms of the sort of moral guilt, the moral guilt doesn't lie with us. As I said earlier on, some of our traders and people of European extraction who were busily building global trading empires, some of those people did dabble in the slave trade, but what we've had is a background of hundreds and hundreds of years, probably thousands of years in fact, of endemic slavery taking place throughout Africa.
It's always been the most abundant commodity that Africa has had. It's always been the most abundant commodity that they've been able to trade with other people has been slaves. And it was like that for thousands of years. And you mentioned Mauritania there. Mauritania only made slavery illegal about 10 years ago. And the real center of the slave trade now is Libya. Liberated Libya, that we went to war and we removed the tyrant Gaddafi, and now that is the centre of the slave trade, apparently. And all these people that go through there trying to make their way into Europe, they get locked up in the prison, and they either have to get someone to pay a ransom to be allowed out, or they get sold off as slaves. And I think it's about $200 to buy yourself a slave.
And none of these modern slavers are using the wealth that they gain as a result of engaging in slavery to build schools,
build up universities in Africa,
churches, in the way that people like Edward Colston did.
It's just hilarious, isn't it? Thinking that they would be building up universities and doing all the great things that were actually done with this wealth from trading. And it really is. I mean, when you think about it, it's just human resources. It was the world back then wasn't like today. You didn't have you didn't get paid for things. You didn't have a shop on the high street where you could go and spend your money. You had to have things provided for you by your employer. If you were a serf, you lived on the serf's land, and you had to go and work in the fields, and you had to go and fight for the lord, your feudal lord or what have you. And in the time of slavery, you had people, they still needed feeding, they still needed a roof over their heads. And when you think today, the amount of money that goes on food, on providing a roof over your head, on providing clothing, it pretty much uses up most of people's wages. Most of people's wages goes on all that. All of that was provided by the slave owner. All of that. It's not like they were mistreating their slaves. Why would you mistreat the people that were working in your fields that you relied upon to pick the cotton? You wouldn't do. It's just today we have this choice, and we have this illusion that because we have all this choice and that we can spend our money and pick what we want to spend our money on, you know, the boss doesn't say, here are the clothes that you're going to wear. We go out and we buy our own clothes. That's the only difference. People still have to work to provide for themselves. And that's all these slaves had to do. They had to work to provide for themselves.
I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to say that, but I think it's fairly obvious that if you compare the population, the black population of North America with the black population of Africa, and ask yourself which of these populations is today better off, I think it's quite clear that the black population of North America is much, much better off, infinitely better off in terms of material wealth, in terms of the education facilities that are made available to them, in terms of the hospital and health services that are made available to them. And given the choice, would you like to live in Africa or in North America, or would you like to return to Africa? I would imagine very, very few of the African Americans living in the United States of America today would actually voluntarily choose to go back to Africa, where they can live as free people in a society that hasn't been tainted by the sort of differential levels of opportunity that they're always going on about. And that in itself says it all, in my view.
Well, they were breeding when they were in slavery. They were breeding once among one another, and you wouldn't get that with white people who were held in captivity. And once they were freed, they didn't go back. And if you look at the white people that were taken by the Barbary pirates, they came back once they were freed. I mean, white Christians went over to Arabia to try and free these people, and once they were freed, they came straight back to Europe. And when you look at what happened with these Negroes in America, they didn't want to go back. And now they're turning around and saying, we want to be paid for a third time. I it's absolutely ridiculous. And really, it doesn't take that much of looking into it to work that out, that hang on a minute. You know, it's these African tribesmen that are at fault, not the white people for buying what the African tribesmen were selling them. I dare say a lot of these people thought, well, these guys are going to be really mistreated by these Africans. You know, it's the right thing to actually buy them and liberate them from Africa. They're this horrible place where they eat one another and it's full of disease, and you know, they don't wear clothes, they don't have any civilization. You know, it's the right thing to take them from there and take them to America and put them with a nice white family that owns a big farm, and you know, they'll have a good life there. I really dare say that the people involved in this, I don't think they were nasty people. And I think we can see the proof of that, as you say, Max, by the things that they built with the money. Universities, hospitals, scholarships for the Negroes. I mean, it's just madness that they bite the hand that feeds them in the way that they do. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. I think that's a great podcast we've had today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
You are listening to Radio Aryan, for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.